And hello, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you some thought, some deep thought. And today, specifically today, we're going to continue in part of our discussion with yesterday in the studio with me, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Nice, because I thought, you know, as our discussions went further and further with this about the effects of Katrina and what we have learned from it from a psychiatric point of view, from a psychological point of view, that we've seen, we're beginning to see some results. Now, before we go specifically there, let's talk a little more about how people deal with this kind of a tragedy, you know, in general, in their minds. And I think we're going to be wind up talking about two things at the same time. We're going to talk about what happened in New Orleans and what happened up here with the rest of us who were observing it. So when you visit, see, and you see this kind of dramatic, intense pain, there seem to be three different ways of dealing with it. There are three ways of dealing with it. One way to deal with it is to, you know, I mean, you keep have an immediate emotional reaction, and sometimes your reaction is so strong, so big, that it gets you away from the actual pain itself. You know, there are people who will go to extreme emotion. Emotion meaning the word emotion. I want to talk about what that means. To emote is emotion. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a valid feeling. But sometimes you just go to extreme emotion as a kind of way of getting rid of pain in your body.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people get overwhelmed with these emotions, and the emotions are so confusing and so extreme that sometimes what's lost is perhaps the core and the real genuine feeling of pain and upset that really needs to be accessed if you really believe you can't heal what you can't feel, right? So these people who are emoting so strongly, sometimes at a very core level, they're not getting to the simple truth, the simple pain of what really is causing them to hurt and have a hard time to really get through and work through and heal that pain, because they're not feeling the real pain. They're overly feeling, overly emoting. They're just, you know, all over the place and overwhelmed, which is not a way to access emotion.
You know, it's hard to say that to somebody, because if you show somebody grieving, you know, and you say to them, you know, well, you know, take it down a peg, they feel an insult, because they say to you, no, this is real, this is my emotion, and if it's my emotion, then it's real. And what you're saying is, you're saying that, you know, that's not your emotion. That's your emote, you know?
Right.
That's what you're doing to block yourself, in many cases, from feeling. But that's one way that people deal with it. Another way is a very interesting thing called a hypomanic defense. Do you want to talk about that one for a moment?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people, when they're feeling pain, or they're feeling sad, or certainly not necessarily related to Katrina, but feeling low about themselves or insecure, so any kind of pain in that regard, you know, pain from something without traumatic, or pain within about some self-esteem or feeling lesser than, there can be this sort of defensive kind of putting on a mask, as it were, to the outside world, that in fact, I'm really upbeat, I'm really happy, I'm really cheerful, you know, let's party, let's dance, let's have fun, let's tell jokes, because it's almost a compensatory, overly presenting to the outside world a very positive, happy, cheerful facade, as if to almost fake myself out that I'm hurting. I'm hurting about something that just happened, or I'm hurting because of the way I really feel about myself. So, you know, I certainly think about people in high school that were, you know, so jokey and so overly on all the time. And, you know, the real person, the real feelings are, you know, one of sadness and blue and the like. But they're certainly in a social context, you know, turning on this hypomanic, this overly up persona to ward off the down, the pain and the hurt that's there.
Yesterday I was watching on television. I saw a commercial for a thing called Meltdown. And a guy says, I'm going to have a meltdown. And his friends are sitting around on a poker game. They say, you're going to have a meltdown. And he said, I'm going to have a meltdown. And they said, you mean you're going to have a deep emotional experience that we're going to have to sit here and watch and feel empathic towards? And the guy says, I'm just going to have a meltdown. They said, all right, well, you're our buddy. If we got to sit through it, go ahead, go through it. And the guy reached out and pulled out a sandwich called the meltdown. And that was the commercial. But it really spoke to this, because part of adolescent male development is to minimize emotions as much as possible. And the hypomanic defense is the one who the leader usually will take. The leader of the pack will move to what's called a positive mind, and in that case, it's a hyper-positive mind. Right. It's a mind that is too positive. You've gone kind of over the edge, you know, and you keep everything smiling. I remember somebody who once went to visit a psychiatrist, and she said to me, I can't go to that psychiatrist, he's too serious. And the reason she said that about him was because she couldn't get him to crack a joke. Meanwhile, she had this tragic life she was leading, and he was just looking at her and more empathizing with her pain, that nothing she said was really funny because he saw the hypomanic defense. So very often people will go to the hypomanic defense because, sounds like something in football. You know, the hypomanic. Well, there they are. They're on the line now. They're coming up to the line. They're using the hypomanic defense. You know, they're all laughing.
Right.
You're not allowed to do that. That's five yards. Okay, the hypomanic defense is something that people will frequently use when they think they're looking at the positive side, but you can actually get lost in it.
It's funny you should say that, because I think, you know, people from the outside can correctly empathize with people's pain, other people's pain, better than some people can even connect with their own pain. I mean, people around can sometimes see somebody putting on this, you know, put on a happy face, didn't Dick Van Dyke sing that 40 years ago, when clearly, you know, you just lost your job or you just lost your house in Katrina. I feel like saying that to George Bush, you know, 3 years into Iraq all the time. It's like, what are you doing, you know? Can't you see the reality on the ground? Is this, are you pulling wool over other people's eyes with this? Or is people like George Bush or other people, do they have a hypomanic defense, meaning they can't really look deep and feel the pain of things that are going wrong, that are painful in their life? There's a defense against it. They're running away from the pain with a smiley, right around the corner, things are going to get great.
And that's where the jokes come from, and the little chuckle that comes underneath it, you know, when he's speaking, right? We hope that it's a hypomanic defense and not psychopathy.
Right.
We just hope it's that. But, you know, as jokey as we get about it, the other thing that people do, and the real subject of today's program, is when you see something really painful, something really hurts you a lot, and you see something that's really almost too much to deal with, sometimes you could, and many people do this, take it and put it in a little back room in your brain and close the door and lock it. You could just say, I can't deal with that. That's too much for me. It's too much. I have to, I can't do it today. Let's say somebody dies suddenly, you know? In fact, I remember once when I was younger, my mother died, and I remember it was sudden. And I went through all the grieving. It was terribly painful. I go through all the grieving. And then a week after, oh, it must have been 2 weeks after she died, my best friend died. And I remembered when I got the message that he died, I said to myself, oh, no, I can't have that on top of this. I'm going to put that somewhere else to deal with for a future time. In fact, I was even asked to make the funeral arrangements. So I went back to the original place where I did my mother's, and I said, just do a repeat. I said, I got a second customer for you. And I remember turning it in the back part of my brain, only to open it up a lot later to have to deal with those feelings. And that's what people do. And one of the things that many people have done down in New Orleans and the area around there, and many of the people up here have done, is they've taken the pain of the realization of what's happened, and they've put it on a back burner. Not even on a back burner. It's in a back room. You lock the door. You skip over the channels, you know, that are showing anything to do with it. Or if you're down there, you try not to look at it. It's pretty hard to deny it. But you try to really put it in the back burner, especially if you've lost a child. If you've lost a child, you know, I mean, how do you get through? How are you somebody with a family of five who loses one of your kids? What do you do to get through? You put it in the back room. It's the only way.
Yeah, and I think that people who maybe get overwhelmed with their emotions, this is sort of almost the all or nothing kind of choice that they have. They feel like either I'm letting it out, I'm putting it in the living room, in which case I can't function. I mean, if the thought and or the emotion of what's troubling is anywhere in my mind, I can't put one foot in front of the other. I can't function. I can't make my life move forward. So which we all have to do. So it's either it's put away and put away out of sight, out of mind, out of my heart and soul's viewpoint, or it's getting to the point where I'm discombobulated. I can't function at all. Now, the problem, as you're implying, is when you're just putting things, shelving it off to the side, putting it in the closet, locking it away, it doesn't go away. The mind doesn't make it go away. It's still there when it's a personal thing. I think going on the show you had yesterday, I mean, as a society, it's sometimes very easy to say, oh, those people in Darfur, the 3,000 people in Iraq, those people down in New Orleans, we just keep it off CNN and keep it out of the news, and we have, you know, happy movies to look at and
And no photographs of coffins coming back, right? No realization of, you know, seeing any dead soldiers, no lists.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just the war that happened was Lebanon and Israel. I mean, the catastrophe that just happened 2 months ago in the world. I mean, if you saw the photos and the movie images of the atrocities of children that were killed in Lebanon, it would be a real downer for us in America. And we want to just put all this, whether it's our personal or our family or our societal pain, and just get it out of the way, and let's just numb with materialism and watching television and maybe having a scotch or two, and let's just try to go forward. As a society, I think you can, as you talked about yesterday, you can almost effectively do it and just cover your eyes and try to ignore it, but then you have no empathy, you have no heart, you have no compassion for fellow human beings. Today, I think we're talking a little bit about individually, and I think we can even talk about the family and the family dysfunction, where things can happen in a family growing up that also have that same feel, which is it's very upsetting, things that are going on with Uncle Joe or Dad when he drinks or whatever. But if we just kind of forget about it, it'll go away. And if we, you know, just if we compartmentalize it, put it away, we can just function fine. But whether it's a family or an individual, that doesn't work, particularly individually. The brain cannot be opted out. If you were sexually abused or molested or had some trauma in a childhood, your brain doesn't let you suppress it, repress it, forget about it. It doesn't work. You can't fool your brain.
Well, you know, there are some things, and I know quite a few people who, when they deal with trauma, that very often one of the ways of treating it is through hypnosis to get it to put it on a back burner until it reduces in its intensity, and then you take it out and you deal with it. You know, you try to reduce the intensity of the, I guess it's all the symbolism of that pain. You know, what happens, the powerlessness and all of that. That is one treatment. And I think in some rooms, the rooms eventually just get all, you know, they get all locked up and they get covered up and you don't even see them anymore. And you go through your entire life never dealing with them. And it doesn't have to haunt you. But it does occupy a space in your brain. So when you're going to look to dance, and you're going to go find, and you're 70 years old, and you say, I think I'll go back to dancing, and you try to stand up, you keep bumping into something, and it's that occupied room that doesn't allow you to have the space, the access to the young you, the you that would be dancing so freely, because you bump into it over and over again. Some people bump into it in the form of ghosts. We did a program about ghosts, where you have recurrent people who you can't stop thinking about over and over again. And these people, these lost relationships, keep coming back, and they get in the way of all other relationships. But for most people, putting it on the back burner, putting it in the back room, is the most efficient way that people have had to dealing with the excruciating pain and realization of some of the horrors that have happened to people over time. It's one of the ways that they do it, and we know eventually we got to open it up. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shore. Now, another way that people deal with this, and I think we're going to go back to dealing with the back burner, the back room phenomena. Another way that people deal with it, Kent, is they kind of look at a pain, and I'm thinking about what we're beginning to see with the children who have been through Katrina and, you know, what's happened to them. And you were beginning to say that many of them are seeing themselves as being responsible.
Yeah, I think that one of the ways of dealing with pain coming from the world around you and the horror and the unpredictability of having something overwhelmingly painful happen in the world around you, the way to get control of the feelings of helplessness and powerlessness that you will have in that situation is to somehow think, I may have done something or I may have caused it. And trust me, this is not just children. I'm sure Armand and myself have worked with many people post September 11th, adults who are beating themselves up. Why didn't I tell my next door neighbor not to go into work that day? With all sorts of things that almost imply that something I feel badly about what just happened because maybe I somehow caused it to happen. Maybe somehow something I did provoked this, or something I could have done could have prevented it. But certainly smaller age children, because they're so egocentric, certainly under 8 years old, they don't understand the concept of hurricanes happening outside of their control and divorces and other things and abuse having outside of their control. Their world is revolved around them. So if something bad happens to me, it's because I'm bad. And that psychologically makes the outside world safer. It makes the outside world safer because if I'm bad and a bad thing happened, then if I'm good and I'm smarter or skinnier or taller or nicer to my grandmother or do something in the future, I will not have such bad things happen. So I will go through my life with low self-esteem, feeling lesser than, because the fact that I'm lesser than is the reason why Katrina happened. It's why Dad used to hit Mom. It's why Mom used to smoke crack. It's because me, I wasn't good enough in some way. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't nice enough. So a lot of insecurities then develop from this sense that something's bad or wrong with me that caused this.
Well, you're saying something really important here, that there's a positive to the reason that people adopt this responsibility. It's called magical responsibility. You know, it has it has this kind of idea behind it. You know, you could be drawing something on a wall when you're a two-year-old and your mother walks in the room and says, look at what you've done, you've given me a headache. And the child actually believes they have created a headache. Right? Then they try to erase it from the wall and the mother says, now look what you've done, you've made it worse. And the child now has in a piece of chalk or a piece of crayon the power to give mom headaches, which he doesn't want to use, and he becomes afraid of his evil powers. Then you're inundated with religion. Now, this is going to be a tough subject because, especially in New Orleans, religion was very, very prevalent and present in so many different forms. God was there doing his work. So many of these children believed that this happened because they were sinners.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why is it that up until recently, up until the last 20 years, they never, in a newspaper, in an obituary, would report if anybody died with cancer? Why was that going on? Well, the idea was that it was shameful to have cancer because only bad people would be somebody that God would have such a horrific disease as cancer. So there, you know, even in many people's psychology today, this idea, again, bad things happen to bad people in a universe ruled over by a very involved and fair God.
And very specific, very involved God, right, who is going to give you cancer, or you're going to get cancer for being tainted and bad. And believe it or not, my friends, of the hundreds of thousands of displaced children out there, many of them are coming back feeling at fault, feeling like they did something wrong, that not only did they cause their own stuff, but they caused it to their families, to their brothers, to their sisters. There are little children who may have lost a brother or sister who blame themselves because they remember the time they said, oh, I wish my brother was dead, as every child says to themselves. And they blame themselves. So are we prepared to deal with this down there? No, they're not that sophisticated yet. You know, we kind of know it maybe up north, but, you know, it's kind of the way we are. They're not so sophisticated down there yet to be dealing with that, and I don't know if they have to be, because the main thing they've got to do is help to get these children back into some kind of shape so that they could function, aside from the children who are functioning from a terrified point of view. I mean, they're just terrified. Mm. What a thing to go through.
I heard somebody say something really wonderful, which was, again, their perspective of God, you know, again, not so much causing tsunamis or you know, airplanes to crash into the 62nd floor and killing the people above and saving the people below. These are sometimes human acts and acts of nature. Where God comes into play is what we briefly said before, which is one human being caring empathically about the other pain, the pain of another human being, that is where God's spirituality is. God is doing his or her work in the interactions between people, which show compassion, altruism, and concern out of what is a very unspiritual place, which a lot of us can go to, myself including, which is a selfish place, and me, you know, as opposed to thinking about others and caring about others and wanting others to be happy and to be well and being concerned with their needs, not just my own.
When you share a tragedy with someone, and you're concerned about them, when you share anything with someone and you're concerned with them and they feel your partnership, that's such a major piece of the healing. Because even if you're encouraging them not to think about it, even if you're saying to them, you know, put it in the back room, we have to get back there, we have to build our house, put it in the back room, we'll deal with it later. But if you do it with love instead of criticism, if you say to them, you know, we'll get there, honey. Right now we have each other. And one of the things that families do with each other is we have each other. And one of the things that friends do with each other is we have each other. For as long as you could get a sense of some kind that you have somebody else there, It makes things a lot more easy, even if you are using all your defenses. But I'll tell you the truth. If somebody, if I saw or I were involved in something tragic and somebody came along with a hypomanic defense and they were just being flippant and lively, I wouldn't want to be with them. Mm-hmm. I'd tell them, no, I'm not going to join you in that one. But I'll join you in denial. I'll join you, in putting it on the back burner. That I'll join you in. No, I won't join you in any extreme that takes me, that really mocks or makes fun of that which has happened. Armand DeMille Kent, Robert Shaw. So we're talking about the children and some of the reactions that the children could possibly have. You know, one of the things that we're going to be seeing is, you can imagine what it's like to try to sleep. Sleep disturbance is one of the prevalent symptoms that have come back from the acute psychiatric symptoms in the Hurricane Katrina evacuee survey, which, believe it or not, we actually have. High increase in depression, high increase, of course, sadness, unhappiness, depression, energia. What's energia?
Low energy, no zip, no zest for living.
You know, it's like kind of walking around like a zombie, distractibility, irritability. And then the sleep disturbance, you know, I mean, for a while you can't sleep, and then you have to catch up on your sleep. And not being able to sleep can have such a dramatic effect on your entire mental health, you know. And then you have this limited affect, limited emotional range, and diminished interest in things, and a lot of avoidant behaviors. You know, they within 1 week of Katrina, these symptoms started appearing and growing and growing and growing, especially with the people who were dislocated, you know, and what happens to them. You know, Kent, isn't it true that there's a tendency to want to put this on some kind of place, not only in a room in your mind, you want to put it at a distance? What was that story about that movie?
Yeah, the movie The Beach with Leonardo DiCaprio, a lot of people didn't see it, but it was a wonderful movie. It's by the same people who did 28 Days and Shallow Grave. It's the Boyle guys from Britain. They love to look at social interactions and social dynamics. And in this movie, basically, Leonardo and a cute girl and a couple other groovy people find this wonderful beach that's deserted and paradise on earth, and they're having fun, drinking, fornicating, hating all the good stuff in life. And halfway through the movie, to give away the plot a little bit, somebody, you know, goes out in the ocean and gets bitten by a shark. And of course, they bring this person back onto this little community of 40, 50 people. And what they find out is this suffering of this person bitten by the shark is bringing the whole community down. It's a real downer having this person. And everyone's upset. No one wants to laugh. No one wants to fornicate. No one wants to have any fun anymore. And so what happens in this movie is what we do as a society a lot with things outside of our immediate self-interest that's a bummer, which is what? Well, they take this guy and they put him on the other side of the island. They isolate him away. They don't see him anymore. They don't hear his groaning. They don't hear his pain. And guess what? They forget all about it and they go right on with their own merrymaking. And, you know, again, that's what I think a lot of us have done in the last year with Katrina. We don't want to look at the photos of how the Ninth Ward is still a nightmare down there, and people are displaced, and people are living like dogs in doghouses, because it's depressing and it's a bummer. And in this movie, it graphically shows that that's something groups of people do. It's a group psychology rather than altruistic things that Muhammad and Jesus and Freud and other empathic, thoughtful people would say we need to care for each other. It's sort of like, Tom Cruise in Rain Man. Again, there's a brother who's got autism and retarded. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want it in my life. I'll just put the person in a group home and go along and be Tom Cruise and be groovy and be charming. And that's kind of a bummer to have a sibling or someone near me. Let's ignore them. Let's alienate them. Let's isolate them. And if we forget about them, then I can just be happy.
When we come back, we're going to discuss alternatives to putting people out to pasture? You know, what's the other ways of dealing with it? You know, one of the things that I said, as I said, as long as we've got each other, as long as we've got our family, including this radio station, we've got a much easier way to go. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We'll be back with you in just a few minutes.
We may not have a chance to pay the rent, but we're gonna make it. I know we will. We may have to eat beans every day, but we're gonna make it. I know we will. And if a job is hard to find, and we have to spend in the West Carolina, I've got your love, and you know you got mine. But we're gonna make it. I know we will. We may not have a home to call our own, but we're gonna make it. I know we will. We may have to fight hardships alone, but we're gonna make it. I know we will. Our togetherness brings peace of mind. We can't.
Little Milton, we're going to make it. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking about people who deal with their feelings by separating out their feelings, by pushing things off at a distance, you know? One of the reasons we put our parents in retirement homes is for that very reason, right? Because you can't deal with the emotion. Not just deal with their caretaking, but you can't deal with the feelings that happen when you're with them. And so we've built institutions for taking people and basically keeping them away from us so that we don't have to deal with it. There must be a... Yeah, I think we have an emergency broadcast happening, are we? Okay, I'm sorry, Kent. I think there was an emergency broadcast right in the middle of that as we were doing that.
Okay,
let's take it back again. Let's start that over.
Well, again, we were talking a little bit about the idea that, you know, when there's people who have things that they're trying to compartmentalize, the painful things, then one of the things that we're saying is that addressing these painful feelings and emotions is important, and having a sense of family and community and others to connect with regarding that is very important. I think one of the tragedies of Katrina has been that people, all communities have been displaced. Families have separated, churches have separated, schools have separated. So people don't have the kind of supports that cause an emotional and spiritual kind of healing, because they've all been spread out over, you know, all over the country. And so they're put in a community where they can't really, resonate and connect with their shared feelings in the same way that other people that have a traumatic experience or a painful experience are less able to reconnect, like at a funeral where everyone's in pain, but at least talking about the person that had died is a way of sharing our shared grief about something. You know, the Katrina, refugees, a lot of them don't have that. They're in Houston and they're separated from other people from New Orleans, so they don't have any place and opportunity to really connect and get some relief and catharsis with the pain they're feeling.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. It's all kind of interesting, Kent, because I think that, you know, when you have somebody who is really bent, I mean, let's say you have somebody who doesn't come up to it and they really feel like they've got to handle it their own way. You know, how often this happens with addiction counseling, I know. I mean, how do you get to them? What do you suggest? How do you get to somebody who is,
Feeling something, feeling some stuff that it's very hard for them to connect with. Well, interestingly, you should say that because I think sometimes more than professionals, people sometimes feel that other people who've had similar experience are the best people who can be empathic and to really know what it's like to walk in my moccasins. You know, do I really know what it's like to be on a roof and be flooded and everything? I can sort of empathically try to connect with that, but I don't know as well as somebody else who also had this happen. And so I think that trying to get through people's defensiveness about their pain, sometimes somebody in a shared or similar experience is in the best position to open that door to the back room that's locked up, saying, you know, I have that same pain. I have that same pain in my locked door in the back. And you know what? It's difficult to deal with, but let's do it a little bit. And I'll help you. I've looked in there. It's not so scary. It's not so horrible. And I think whether it's, post-traumatic from Vietnam or people who've been abused or neglected, that's where, or cancer survivors or family members, that these support groups become very powerful sources of healing, hope, and health.
You know, I'd like to hear from some of our audience, and I'm hoping that one of the things we do is we don't use this as a format just for the politicking obvious statements, which is there's been a crime, the crime is still going on, that whether or not our president takes full responsibility for all of the neglect, it doesn't do us much good. But let's get off that wagon. You know, let's try to see what you were dealing with emotionally, and we'll take some of your calls. 212-209-2900 is our number. We're talking about the emotional reactions that people have had both while there and both away. And I wonder if there's sorenesses. I remember during 9/11, and right as 9/11 happened and every anniversary of 9/11, we would have a program where we would talk about some of the emotional reactions that people were having. And beyond the people who had decided to stand on soapboxes and talking about, this is what should happen and what the government did. The people with the feelings and the emotions did not have a format. They didn't have a way that they could really talk about it, as Kent is suggesting. So 212-209-2900 is our number, and I would like to hear from you. 212-209-2900. I'd like to hear what you have to say about this. And this may have been a little too fast, and I'm sneaking it up on you, Michael, but I'd love to take a call. Would you let me know if we get a call on air?
Yes, hello, Armand.
Yes.
Hello, this is Pat. I hear what you're saying concerning the Katrina, but I'm a nurse, and we are constantly confronted with death. And one of the things that I have a great deal of feelings about is how this culture deals with death, or rather does not deal with it. I also had to, unfortunately, witness my parents having to have heroic measures, although they didn't want it, and being placed on ventilators. So as a result of these things...
What do you mean by heroic measures?
Well, unfortunately, they had a heart attack outside, and I wasn't there. They placed him on ventilators, you know, the full resuscitative measures and things like that and all that goes along with that, even though they were in vegetative states. This happened at different periods, of course. But I then had to fight the system and ethics committees trying to get them off, and my parents were very clear in terms of what they wanted and what they did not want.
So, if you would, from your heart, what happens when you're dealing with families who are dealing with death, and they have to deal with death? What do you generally, as a nurse, as watching it, as seeing it, as being in the middle of it, as being a person who has the kind of apathy that you have and the caring that you have, what is the lesson you would like to give them? What could you convey? What would you wish you could convey?
Well,
and who would you want to convey it to?
I have a lot of empathy. Unfortunately, oddly enough, the traditional traditional medicine community has really brainwashed the public, and they have no idea what's waiting for them in these facilities. If they don't get into one that is progressive, they're in a lot of trouble. And as a result, if I could just really quickly relate an experience that happened yesterday, I've learned that I need to deal with this in terms of my own life. And so I went to a doctor trying to get my papers in order just in case, so I don't have to relive what my parents did. And I was attempting to have the doctor sign a DNR, a New York State DNR form, and he threw me out of the office. This literally happened yesterday.
Why would you choose a doctor who would throw you out of the office?
Well, unfortunately, what happens is we are assigned, in a benefit fund, we are assigned doctors. So I didn't know this
doctor. Not much
choice.
One of the things that happen, Okay, so you got a DNR, and I guess one of the reasons that doctors don't want to sign DNRs is they're afraid of liability. It's the only reason I could imagine, right?
Well, I don't think it's just liability, truthfully. One of the things that occurs in these institutions, and I hate to say it, it's very raw and it's very graphic, but your body will be used for full capitalist profit, and that's the truth. And the public may not want to face it, but every last dollar is squeezed out of your body in terms of ordering all kinds of procedures that are often invasive and painful for the profit of the system. I have seen people who have been riddled from stem to stern, you know, with cancer, 98 years old, and they will call a code on them. And they will inflict every single type of medical procedure on them, when the most compassionate thing would be to let them go.
So let's go back to your feelings. Besides your statement about injustices, which I know you can make, and I know you have absolutely every right to, and thank you for bringing it up, but I'm talking about your feelings. What happens to you emotionally when someone dies and you're dealing with their family? What do you go through? What happens? I mean, does the system say, if someone says, you know, I'm sorry they didn't make it, you know, what would you like to see happen?
If I'm able to, I try to, at the point where the person has expired?
No, I would say near death, because one of the things that nobody ever wants to talk about is death and dying, and they certainly don't want to talk about it as it's happening, you know, and they don't want to talk about it, they don't want to recognize it, and from what we've seen from our profession, it would be a great advantage to be able to talk about it, you know, while it's happening and what the possibility is.
Well, what I try to do is to carefully, cautiously feel how the person interprets this experience, because many of them interpret it and only trust a very medicalized view. If I see that they can approach a spiritual point of view, or you know, I try to feel them out. Because you have to be careful what you're saying. There are cases where I've tried to hint to the person, you know, that their loved one might be better in a hospice, as an example. But then I'll run into a very traditional type of thing. They need to be here in the hospital, and they need so forth and so on and such and such. So you have to be careful what you're saying, because the public, as you try to help them, they will be the first ones to run to the doctor and say, she said.
And then what would happen to you?
You'll be punished.
You'll be punished.
You'll be punished.
So you have to be, you have to never, you're saying that in your chosen profession, you cannot do what you think is wisest.
You cannot do what you
think. In fact, you have to lie. In fact, you have to go along with the systemic lie. You know, and that's part of being a nurse. Part of being a nurse is be careful. Don't ever step outside of your bounds, because if you do, we're going to punish you. What a profession.
Well, unfortunately, people define this, and if you are not in step within the system, you can get into a lot of trouble. And those of us who are not supportive of the system, we find ways, but you have to do it very carefully.
I understand. No, I truly, truly understand. I've just always been someone who, every time a family's come to me with a person who's dying, I've encouraged them, talk to them about dying. You're going to find a tremendous relief. And when they finally bring up the subject of talking to someone who is dying about their death, that person has a tremendous relief. There's a great thing. When those kids down right now, down in New Orleans, when they're talking, you know, where is Aunt Sadie, you know? Are they saying, oh, she floated off to heaven? Or are they saying she died in the flood? The common thing for people to do is do the denial of death and not help children deal with death and finality. And it's painful, and it's not very effective.
Well, unfortunately, your hospitals, your average hospital, is really not interested in a therapeutic response when they're dealing with
the family. They just want to stay out of trouble and make sure they don't get sued.
And they don't want their staff standing around for a long time, talking about death and trying to help the public. You know, it's action-oriented. It's kind of like health production factory, and that's your average hospital. There are some good hospitals out there. You know, so the first thing, if they found you, talking to the family for too long, it's perceived as something other than what it is.
I thank you so much for your call. You brought some sensibilities to us.
Yeah, I think that this idea of dealing with death, and again, talk about not wanting to face things that are difficult. I run into lots of people having such a hard time visiting family members who are sick and dying, because it's so uncomfortable, and I think that that's something we also want to validate for people, which it is uncomfortable, you know, that it's uncomfortable to be with people you care about when they're ill, when they're sick. That's all right. It's all right. Don't feel guilty. Don't feel like you're a bad person because you don't want to go to the hospital, or it's difficult to go. It's difficult to see someone you care about in pain. That uncomfortability is very human, you know. We're not, you know, Gandhi or Jesus Christ and perfect, you know. We have very mixed feelings about death and dying and being with people. Clearly, though, the people who avoid the right thing to do, the ethical, moral right thing to do, when somebody does pass on, the guilt that they then feel about how they didn't go to the hospital and visit when they could have is sometimes overwhelming. So that's why it is important to really validate that it's okay that you're uncomfortable going, but, you know, you have to go, because the alternative is you're left with all this wish that you would go now, and you can't once the person is dead.
You know, and another thing, right now as we speak, Kent, people are tuning us out. Right now, there are people shutting off the radio. Oh, I guess the program's over, right? And without even knowing it, because of this importance of this denial of death. But it is the very same thing that is letting us deal with Iraq and not see the number of dead there, and the number of dead people in Lebanon and in Israel, and the number of dead people all over the world that we're a part of. We don't consider it death. We don't consider it it's not real.
Right.
And it's surreal. It's like we've removed ourselves from it. Just as many of you have turned down your dial now because you think the program's over because we're talking about the heavy stuff. Do you know if I have announced in advance next week I'm going to do a show on death? we'd have dead air.
Yeah. I think it's kind of unusual that this very complicated issue of at the end of life, whether you do all sorts of heroic efforts when 95 year olds are dying, whether that amounts to, you know, killing somebody. Because I think in a very conservative religious view that I certainly don't share about, you know, thou shalt not kill, for some people's thinking that would mean that you have to do everything possible at the end of someone's life to keep someone alive. Otherwise, you're breaking the sixth commandment of thou shalt not kill. And then that same person reads that there's 140,000 Iraqi civilians that have died in the last 3 years and doesn't blink an eye. And it's paradoxical, you know, because I would think that that's murder. That's killing civilians in Iraq. That's murder. That's what the sixth commandment is all about. I'm not sure people near the end of their life, dying with dignity, making their own life choices, as this nurse just talked about how to choose, not in a depressed, suicidal place, but a place of dignity as my body and as nature is causing my body to now wind down.
And to make your choices and to say it's mine.
It's my body.
It's my body. I want to go. I want to be conscious of it as it goes. This is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Show. We got time to take one more fast call. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. How are you?
Good. Who is this?
My name is Carrie. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Carrie, we got a good 2 minutes. Let's go for it.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the fact that you're talking about death, because I lost my mom some years ago, and I went through a serious problem with depression. I went through grief counseling, and make a long story short, it seems that it didn't affect my brothers and sisters as much as it did me. And going to grief counseling and watching others cry when they've lost others to accidents or murders or whatever, it didn't help me. It only made matters worse. But to make a long story short, I now, whenever there's a family member that's close to death or very ill, I make it a point to reach out for them. I make it a point to go to friends, families, and go to funerals, because the one thing that I remember when my mom was sick and dying was those people that comforted me. So now it's made me a much better person, I think, to accept the inevitable and to help that person that's dying or that family that has died. Because families need that support so they don't feel alone. And that's the point that I wanted to make, that people need to reach out to other people and feel their pain. When you walk in my shoes and you feel what I feel, the one thing that I find very vivid after all these years are those faces that surrounded me and gave me comfort, so that now I feel I can be a better person and give back some of the love and comfort that I received. Where before I was one of those that didn't go to a funeral unless it was a family friend, family or friends, but now I'm just the opposite. And that's all I want to say is people need to be mindful of how other people feel. And they also need to be mindful of that person that's dying and be able to talk to them in a realistic way in terms of what their needs are and what they're feeling. That's all I have to say. Thank you so much.
Well, apparently he wasn't kidding when, that is, Armand DeMille wasn't kidding when he said that he was going away, or that you thought he was going away. I don't know. A good note to end on. Thank you to the last caller for your words of wisdom and comfort to all of us. Here in the listening area of 99.5 FM, which is about 100 miles, we learn, in all directions from the Empire State Building. Depending upon where you are, you've been listening to The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. Thank you very much, Armand, for bringing up this issue, for raising this issue, particularly in the latter half of the program. You're tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio, WBAI, wbai.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Coming up next at 2 will be Real World with Mike Sargent. And at 3 o'clock, sitting in for Hugh Hamilton and Talkback, African American Humanism and Atheism, that's coming up at 3 p.m. So I encourage you, and we here at WBAI encourage you to tune in at 3 p.m. for African American Humanism and Atheism. Barry Seidman will be co-hosting this program for Talkback. Talkback is the program that Hugh Hamilton hosts Monday through Thursday, 3 to 5 p.m. Hugh Hamilton is on vacation at the present. He'll be back on the 13th. We'll make that announcement one more time before we approach 3 p.m.